The numbers out of Ukraine are no longer just a casualty count. They are a structural verdict. In April 2026, Russian forces suffered 35,203 confirmed, killed, or seriously wounded, a figure reported directly by Ukrainian Defense Minister Mykhailo Fedorov on May 5th, with every casualty cross-referenced through Ukraine's Army of Drones video confirmation system. Now set that against what Russia can actually replace. An estimated 800 volunteer recruits per day, which translates to roughly 24,000 personnel in a given month. The gap is approximately 11,000 soldiers in a single month. Over the five-month window from December 2025 through April of this year, Russia accumulated a net manpower shortfall of around 8,300 soldiers. That figure may sound modest against the scale of this war, but the strategic calculus here is not about the raw number. It's about the direction. Russia has crossed a threshold. For the first time in this conflict, it is losing personnel faster than it can recruit them. The cost geometry is equally striking. Ukraine's unmanned systems forces accounted for 10,581 confirmed Russian eliminations in April alone, roughly 30% of Ukraine's total monthly kills, at a documented cost of $882 per Russian soldier eliminated. Russia's average volunteer signing bonus now stands at approximately $19,600. Commander Robert Brovdy framed it directly. Exchanging enemy resources for the plastic and metal of a drone is, in his words, one of the most effective exchange rates in modern warfare. The historical resonance here is deliberate and important. Imperial Germany in 1917 and 1918 faced a structurally identical dilemma. A war of attrition whose casualty rates had outpaced its manpower base. The Hindenburg program succeeded in rationalizing industrial output, but could not replenish the Western Front. Germany's spring offensives of 1918 were launched precisely when manpower was most depleted, a strategic gamble on forcing a decision before collapse. The gamble accelerated the collapse it was designed to prevent. Putin is approaching a compressing decision corridor. One path is accepting accelerating forced degradation. The other is forced mobilization, which carries severe domestic political costs that Russia's September 2022 partial mobilization made viscerally clear, triggering mass protests and an estimated 500,000 to 700,000 Russians fleeing the country. The Kremlin's reported planning for a limited conscription system represents a graduated probe, testing domestic reaction before committing to broader compulsion. And critically, the approach of firm summer terrain will predictably increase Russian offensive tempo, driving casualty rates even higher as assault formations enter established drone kill zones. Intensifying operations to achieve territorial objectives will accelerate the very manpower crisis that threatens operational sustainability. One additional signal is worth watching beneath the battlefield data. Jason Smart's reporting, citing The Economist, identifies approximately $66.4 billion in assets confiscated across Russia over the past 3 years. One in eight individuals on Russia's Forbes list has had assets seized by the state. The arrest of Vadim Muscovich, a billionaire co-owner of a strategic wartime food logistics company and a United Russia Party member previously elevated to the Federation Council, signals that regime-compliant insiders whose political status once provided protection are no longer structurally insulated. The Kremlin's informational discipline appears to be fracturing as well. The fact that insiders are speaking to Western press represents a breach that, in prior cases of authoritarian stress, has preceded more significant defections. On the far side of the Eurasian landmass, a different kind of strategic reckoning is underway, one measured not in monthly casualty counts, but in warheads and flight times. Victor Cha of SASIS, who served on the U.S. six-party talks delegation, has assessed that North Korea now possesses an estimated 50 nuclear weapons, with sufficient fissile material to construct approximately 50 more. The U.S. intelligence community has confirmed that North Korean ballistic missiles can reach every region of the continental United States. These assessments, corroborated by the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists and Siegfried Hecker's Stanford Research, represent the functional collapse of the CVID framework, complete, verifiable, irreversible denuclearization, which has structured American policy toward Pyongyang since the 1994 agreed framework. The strategic calculus here is uncomfortable but inescapable. The diplomatic architecture built to contain North Korea's nuclear program was designed for a Pyongyang that did not yet have 50 weapons. That Pyongyang no longer exists. Building on that, Che proposes what he calls a cold peace framework, published in Foreign Affairs, which explicitly deprioritizes near-term denuclearization in favor of four operational threat management pillars: limiting long-range ballistic missile deployments targeting the United States, preventing nuclear first use in Northeast Asia, weakening the Russia-North Korea relationship, and reducing the adversarial roster through selective engagement. The most urgent rationale for this reorientation is structural rather than diplomatic. The United States currently has no direct real-time communication channel with Pyongyang capable of providing an answer within a 24-minute ICBM flight window. There is no hotline. No crisis management architecture. A miscalculation, a drone incident in the West Sea, a naval clash along the inter-Korean border, could trigger escalatory sequences with nothing in place to interrupt them. More importantly, the leverage that made prior diplomacy theoretically viable has been structurally eroded. Sidney Seiler, former National Intelligence Officer for North Korea at the National Intelligence Council, characterizes China's posture as having shifted from ambiguously helpful to aggressively unhelpful. And Russia has created an entirely new economic lifeline for Pyongyang through the Ukraine war transactional relationship. Satellite imagery of the Tumangan-Kasan railway crossing, one of two North Korean rail connections to Russia, shows new buildings, storage facilities, and monument construction consistent with high-volume material flows that did not exist a decade ago. North Korea is providing Russia with troops and artillery ammunition. Russia is providing weapons technology, food, fuel, and what Seiler characterizes as a security guarantee architecture approximating the Cold War-era Soviet alliance treaty with Pyongyang. The last substantive USDPRK engagement on delivery systems was the Einhorn-Lee-Yongho missile talks of October 2000, a 25-year gap that Shaw considers indefensible given the pace of North Korean development. Kim Jong-un's current leverage position is materially stronger than it was at the 2018 Singapore summit. He holds a quasi-alliance with Russia, expanded Chinese economic support, and a U.S. president who has expressed personal desire for a meeting. Trump's anticipated summit with Xi Jinping in Beijing represents the most proximate opportunity to facilitate Kim Jong-un contact. Per Cha's assessment, such a meeting could materialize with as little as 24 hours public notice. The thread connecting the Ukraine theater and the Korean Peninsula runs directly through Brussels, or more precisely, through the fractures forming within NATO's collective architecture. The proximate trigger for the current burden-sharing crisis was not, as is often framed, a dispute over GDP spending percentages. It was operational. Allied nations, including some hosting American forward-deployed forces, reportedly refused to provide basing rights, airspace access, or naval assets in support of U.S. military operations against Iran. The countries that did provide operational cooperation were Gulf states, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, the UAE, Bahrain, and Kuwait, none of them NATO members, all of them with direct threat perception alignment with the U.S. on Iran. The strategic calculus here shifts the entire meaning of Article 5. If collective defense is perceived as conditional on operational reciprocity rather than geographic trigger alone, Baltic states and Poland face an acute security dilemma. Their threat environment from Russia is immediate. Their capacity to compel U.S. operational loyalty without participating in out-of-theater operations is limited. The Gyuk Gap, Greenland, Iceland, the United Kingdom, is the foundational geographic rationale for NATO's North Atlantic posture. It controls Russian submarine and surface vessel access to the Atlantic. Any fragmentation of alliance control over that geography, through U.S. posture shifts, Greenlandic autonomy changes, or Chinese infrastructure penetration, which Beijing has documented attempts to pursue in Greenland, degrades the West's ability to interdict Russian naval movements in a crisis scenario. The shifting geography of power in the North Atlantic is not hypothetical. It is a live operational variable. Germany is the primary illustration of the structural asymmetry that has generated this friction, sustaining defense expenditure below 2% of GDP for extended periods while building expansive social infrastructure, effectively borrowing fiscal space that should have been allocated to defense. The 2014 Wales summit benchmark was not met meaningfully by most allies until Russia's 2022 full-scale invasion of Ukraine made the cost of underinvestment impossible to ignore. The 2003 Iraq War provides the most proximate precedent for Allied operational non-cooperation, but the Iran case, if accurately characterized, extends non-cooperation to nations with forward-deployed U.S. forces, which is qualitatively different.
The Suez Crisis of 1956 offers the inverse precedent. U.S. pressure forced Allied military withdrawal, demonstrating that transatlantic solidarity has always been conditioned by divergent national interests. One structural dimension of great power competition that rarely receives adequate attention in the daily news cycle is the industrial layer underneath the deterrence architecture, specifically the hypersonic capability gap that has opened between the United States and its peer competitors. James Swartout of Ursa Major has traced the origins of this gap to a 1993-1994 consolidation of the U.S. defense industrial base, the so-called Last Supper, which reduced major defense primes from over a dozen to approximately five, followed by a roughly 25-30-year procurement reorientation toward counterterrorism and counterinsurgency operations. Advanced conventional strike capabilities atrophied. China and Russia pursued hypersonic development at scale during the same period. Russia has already employed the Kinzhal air-launched ballistic missile operationally in Ukraine. What's analytically significant about Ursa Major's approach is its cost logic. The Havoc missile system is explicitly architected to avoid the exotic metallurgy of hyperglide vehicles and scramjet designs that drives unit costs beyond procurement at scale thresholds. The company has confirmed over 100 engines produced, more than 100,000 seconds of hot fire testing, and 16 flights across product lines in partnership with the Air Force Research Laboratory. The DoD's documented doctrinal shift from just-in-time to just-in-case procurement reflects a direct lesson from Ukraine. High-end munitions exhaust at rates that outpace industrial replenishment under sustained combat.
The Taiwan Strait contingency is the primary driver of urgency, with Chinese hypersonic development within a mature anti-access and area denial architecture, creating both the offensive threat and the target set. Demonstrating sustained production rates, not merely successful tests, remains the critical unverified variable. Three compounding pressures on the Western-led international order are converging simultaneously: a Russian military in net manpower deficit, a North Korean nuclear program that has structurally outpaced the frameworks designed to constrain it, and a NATO alliance experiencing its most significant internal cohesion stress since Iraq. What connects them is a cooperative counter-architecture: Russia, China, Iran, North Korea, operating across military, diplomatic, economic, and informational domains at precisely the moment when the Western order's internal coherence is under demonstrable strain. In the next 48 hours, the single highest signal indicator to monitor is Putin's Victory Day appearance at Moscow's Red Square ceremony on May 9th. A live address confirms functional regime capacity. A pre-recorded address or an absence compounds an anomaly that Putin's own information managers have already been working to manage. How the Kremlin stages that moment will tell us more about the internal political architecture of the Russian state than any battlefield report. Thank you for listening. That's your geopolitical risk briefing for today. The signals are moving quickly. Join us again tomorrow for the next strategic update. Stay vigilant. Until tomorrow. That's your CEOR brief for today. Thanks for listening. We'll be back tomorrow with more.